My worry, my fear, is that we suddenly have AI does all of that for us, and we're left thinking, well, who am I? What am I? What's the point of me? What we need to be doing is designing a system which gets those young people to the point where they can be useful in the world. And that, do you know what? That use might come age 12. The more we can move towards having teachers who embody what they love and embody what they teach, I just think that for me is like the most important thing about being a teacher, because it connects what you're teaching with how you live your life. And if you connect those two together, I think for children, that's incredibly powerful.
Hello and welcome to the Coconut Thinking Podcast. I'm your host, Benjamin Freud, and today's guest is Darren Coxon. Darren is founder of Coxon AI, a worldwide strategic advisory specializing in K-12 AI implementation. An educator for 25 years, Darren has most recently managed the operation of schools groups, notably Brighton College's International Schools, Forfar Education, and Brighton's Education in Bahrain, where he was the COO. Darren has been at the forefront of educational technology for many years, including leading the first sixth form college in the UK to move to an iPad one-on-one model. He's now a major thought leader on AI education, and he's delivered training for COBUS and the National College, as well as more recently delivering keynotes and workshop for HMC, GS Dubai, and the Cottesmore AI Festival. Darren is one of those rare people who comes from education and has such a deep knowledge of technology through an avid and really hungry desire to learn and make sense of the world. He's really become an AI expert. And on this podcast, we touch on a lot of topics, including, of course, learning and regeneration, but also AI. AI not because it's a trend, but because of the possibilities that might open up there. Actually, the theme of this podcast is the dystopian and utopian futures, the possible futures that AI might open up, whether we go to a 20-hour work week, to a zero-hour work week, or if we continue to push productivity, which of course pushes other things like GDP, and never mind the alienation that we feel, specifically when we have the risk of AI. So there's a lot going on in this conversation that goes beyond AI, but also how the current education model is no longer fit for purpose. And of course, what AI might mean for the world of sustainability and regeneration. Check us out, www.coconut-thinking.com. Again, that's www.coconut-thinking.com. And I'll leave space for my conversation with Darren. Hi, Darren. It's an absolute pleasure to speak with you. You and I've had quite a few chats on Zoom and talked, and it's been great to riff. So I thought we would have another one of those and record it and see if other people found it interesting. And the first question I have is, who are you and what story do you want to tell?
Who am I? So yeah, hi, I'm Darren Coxon. So I have been teaching people, mainly small people, for 25 years now. So this is my 25th year in education. And it's been a wild ride. I taught in the world's most expensive school. I've ran a boarding house there and went skiing with the kids and climbing up mountains with them. And I've also taught in some of the most challenging schools and areas in the UK. So it's been an interesting career. My story, I guess, is getting into education. I don't think it's necessarily unorthodox, but I didn't go immediately into education, into university. I took several years out, traveled across the world. I worked as a portrait photographer and got attacked by dogs, and trying to take photographs of dogs is not a very good idea. They don't like having formal portraits taken. Dogs and two-year-old children, generally avoided. And then I worked in a children's home with boys, very, very difficult backgrounds. And so my story, I suppose, is one of coming into teaching from a background which is not as conventional as many, but probably not hugely unconventional. But it definitely gave me an understanding as to, A, the benefits of education, because obviously we're particularly working with boys from very difficult backgrounds that really weren't getting that sort of education. But also just to give me a sense of a broader world, a world beyond the classroom, which I think is actually really beneficial when you're a teacher.
I usually ask the question to follow this up with, what does learning mean to you? But with you, we're going to ask a slightly different question, which is, what does machine learning mean to you?
Oh, well, I guess if you look at how machines learn and how humans learn, there are some parallels, because essentially learning is taking in data, some shape or form, and then making sense of that data and then building on that knowledge on an iterative process. So I guess, you know, when we talk about machine learning, what we're essentially talking about are machines which are gaining some form of intelligence. And I don't really like the term artificial intelligence, as many of us don't like that term, some sort of machine intelligence, through collecting lots of different types of data and organizing it and making sense of it. And I think if you compare that to how humans learn, we can certainly see that there are parallels between the two. Obviously, there are many, many points of difference, but essentially the more that we develop, the more we develop these artificial intelligence systems, particularly the more we move towards what we call AGI or artificial general intelligence, the more I believe that we will start to see these, the ways in which we learn as human beings and the ways in which machines learn, there will be points of convergence. The other thing, of course, to say is that how we learn is that we are and have been for really as long as we've been learning, particularly in a formal capacity, we are augmented by the tools around us. And so whilst you could say that machines and humans learn in different ways, actually humans have been augmented by machines of some sort or tools of some sort for a long time, even way back to the invention of the printing press or even the invention of the pen. It's still a tool that we use to augment our intelligence. So when we talk about machine learning, it's actually quite hard to divide just the machine learning from human, because actually we're going to see them converging more and more. And of course, machine learning has come from human learning, because it's been created by man. So there's definitely an overlap between the two.
And I guess the first question I'll ask you about this, just to make sure that our audience is on the same page, is what do you mean by general intelligence, artificial general intelligence, as opposed to generative?
Yeah, so look, you can basically define AI or artificial intelligence as a computer system which can engage in tasks and thinking in a similar way to a human. So the way that the neural network, it's not identical, but the way a neural network processes information and learns is similar to the way that a human learns. At the moment, we have what is called narrow artificial intelligence. So we have artificial intelligence, which is intelligences which are good at specific functions. So one might be a large language model where you put text in and you get text out at the end, or you put text and you get an image out at the end, or music or whatever it is, or video. You might have AIs which help to direct your car, or AIs which help to, or which win play chess. They all have a specific or narrow function. When we talk about an AGI or an artificial general intelligence, we're talking about an AI which will basically be able to do what humans can do as well as humans can do it. So it will have a broad range of functions. An AGI will be able to engage in a number of different tasks in the way that a human can engage in tasks and do them as well, if not better. The next stage would be some form of super intelligence, which actually will do all of the things that humans can do, but faster, better, more in more creatively or what have you. But we're not at the stage yet, certainly not publicly, where we have AGI in the world. But lots of the people who are far cleverer than I am believe that it is just around the corner. You know, that we are, that companies like Google and OpenAI and Meta are already developing these AGIs. It's just, at what point do we see them in the world? And what does that actually mean for us as human beings?
And from your sense, knowing that we can't predict the future, and I don't see a crystal ball on the screen here, this is quite a threatening piece for many people, that we're going to be replaced, that humans might be really redundant. And when you say the things, like what kind of things are we talking about? Are there constraints to those things, or are there really, like, are the constraints so wide that they might as well not exist? Those things that you say that will do better than humans.
Yeah. So, I mean, just the fact that even now, if we look at let's just take ChatGPT. Let's just take the free version of ChatGPT. You can ask the most basic level for ChatGPT to write an essay. And this is, you know, this is kind of the first thing that anyone thinks about, which is why I mention it. First thing people think about is, oh my goodness me, it's, you know, the essay's dead, which, to be fair, it kind of almost is. And it will create a pretty good essay in a minute, 30 seconds. So it's already able to do things that humans can do far, far faster. And it's what I actually kind of term almost like level one AI use, the generating stuff, creating stuff, writing essays, writing reports, writing policy documents, writing emails, whatever it is. It can already do things in a narrow way, very, very fast. What we will see with AGI is it will be able to do broadly everything that we can do within reason, faster than we can. And of course, then if you bring AGI into robotics, you then have embodied AI. Because of course, when we talk about ChatGPT and Bard and what have you, what we're actually talking about is disembodied. It's on a screen. But as soon as you have an AI which is embodied in a robot, then you start to talk about, well, actually the AI can physically do all of the things that we as humans can do. It's a long way personally that before we get to that point, and then we get into the whole territory that, you know, that we've seen with Terminator and Skynet and all of the kind of doomer narrative that people start worrying about. If we have super intelligent AI, which is embodied, then why will it need us? I mean, I think that's not necessarily linking to education a route that I like talking about or going down. But I do think that what we will soon start to see is where we are going to have to redefine who we are as human beings. We're going to have to, because, you know, if you look at what Yuval Noah Harari has been saying, you know, anyone who follows his work, you know, he gave the Frontier speech just about sort of April or May of last year. And he basically said, you know, this is the first time in 4 billion years we've had a new life form that's as intelligent or potentially more intelligent than we are. Yes, it's silicon-based, not carbon-based, but the way he talks about it, it's like we have a new alien intelligence who's landed on our planet who will be able to do things faster, better, more efficiently than we can. It does mean that we're going to have to redefine who we are as a human race.
I also am thinking of some of the conversations that we have had in terms of this, not necessarily leading to Armageddon, like you said, Terminator style, but perhaps some opportunities. 100 years ago, a little bit less than 100 years ago, people were on the streets demanding a 40-hour work week. Could this potentially liberate us from work in the sense of how we know it today and allow us to explore new areas, because we do have these robots, for a better word, who are able to take on some of the stuff that we do now as the mundane, which again, as you mentioned earlier, technology has always done, facilitated our ability to do.
Yeah. I mean, there is one argument to say yes. You know, the notion of kind of a new era of abundance, which will appear as a result of AI basically doing all the things that we don't want to do faster and cheaper than we can. And therefore it releases this new era of abundance. So yes, I think there is definitely that potential. I mean, I'm already seeing, you know, in my role and what I do, I'm already seeing significant productivity gains with AI. I mean, this is not, you know, I remember when we first started to explore cryptocurrencies, and I got in fairly late. I mean, not as late as some, but fairly late. And there was a lot of hype and a lot of kind of, you know, promise about what crypto and blockchain may or may not do. And that still may transpire. I mean, it may well be that we do see particularly blockchain technologies actually having impact. But the fact remains is that even though I was interested in it and very to very minor level investing, I mean, I never invested more than pocket money, unlike some people who kind of basically bet their lives and lost everything. I never saw any utility. Not once did I ever think, oh my goodness me, you know, I can see blockchain right now in my life having an impact. Totally different with AI. So I'm already using it on a day-by-day basis. You know, I use it to brainstorm and ideate. I use it to draft documents. I use it to think around a subject. And I use it for so many different functions. So I am definitely seeing that it's significantly impacting my productivity now. And it is what I call anyone who's born kind of before 1980 or 1975. I equate this to the ZX Spectrum period of AI development. So ZX Spectrum was a home computer developed in the early 80s by Clive Sinclair. It was very, very basic, but it brought computing into the homes for the first time. It was one of the first like consumer focused, it wasn't aimed at geeks, it was aimed at normal people. And so what it did is it brought home computing into people's homes. And it was, you know, it wasn't easy to use, but it was very basic. I equate where we are with AI right now to that period, because for the first time we've got ChatGPT coming into our homes, but it's very, very basic. At the point where we start seeing these hints of AGI, so, you know, when we get ChatGPT-5, which is the next iteration, my assumption will be, it may not be full AGI, but it will certainly have signs of a significantly advanced intelligence across many, many fields to our own. And I think at that point, I can only see this product, these productivity gains going up. And then that, and at that point, it leads you to the question, well, what can we genuinely give to AI that means we don't have to do it? And what's really interesting, actually, Benjamin, is that even in my consultancy, I'm seeing a shift in what people want. So previously it was very much, you know, go and give a keynote, go in and do a workshop. And that's fine. And I continue to do that. But I'm now working with a number of bodies, affiliate bodies and groups, looking at how you can use the current suite of tools just to make increase efficiencies across all of the whole piece. So look at, you know, how can you use AI across every single function of a school or a school group? So it's much more systematic. So it's a much more of a systems level work. So I'm doing a lot more of that. And I can actually see that just only increasing, because more and more schools and groups and businesses are thinking, okay, I need to kind of look at it, not just for training some of my staff how to use ChatGPT, but actually the whole gamut. So if that's the case, the next logical conclusion will be, well, if we do that systematically, more and more systematically, what we are going to find eventually is that actually it's doing more and more of what we would normally do. So the next question is, well, what's left for us? What's left for us? And the optimist in me thinks, you know, we will get to the point where almost in a kind of 19th century, the sort of landed gentry, we're able to go on and travel the world and read literature and host parties and explore interesting things and write the novel we've always wanted to write and, you know, write bad poetry or learn musical instrument, you know. So that's the optimist in me thinks actually what it could do is it could create a very different way of being for many people, not for everyone. And there will be a divide, and there is a divide. And I can't see that necessarily suddenly disappearing. I mean, they may well unlock brilliant people in other parts of the world that wouldn't have had their brilliance unlocked. But generally, there is going to be a divide. But what we might see is that, you know, a large percentage of the population, the likes of you and I, for example, might actually have more time and more money and enjoy it. The flip side, of course, is that, you know, if you look at from basic human psychological needs, we need goals, yeah? Human beings need goals. We need to be working towards something. We need to feel like, whether it be from a physical or metaphysical or spiritual way, we need to feel like we're working in something that's bigger than ourselves. You know, we need a mission. My worry, my fear, is that we suddenly have AI does all of that for us, and we're left thinking, well, who am I? What am I? What's the point of me if actually the things that define me as a human being and the goals that I was aiming for and the motivating factors are removed? And yes, I've got plenty of time, I've got plenty of money, and I've got plenty of time. But if you look at anyone who's won the lottery, unless they do something with their money, they often end up really depressed. So my worry, I suppose, is that if so many of the goals and things that we aim for and strive for are removed from us by AI, actually we end up thinking, well, what do I do?
And it's this whole trope that actually heaven seems like a very boring place when you have everything at your disposal for eternity. Yeah. What's the point?
Yeah.
I'm really interested in this, but because you brought in the 70s, and I remember my first computer was an Amstrad that I loaded a tape with. And
yeah. I remember the Amstrad as well.
You walked away 45 minutes later, you played this, 8-bit game. But you brought up the 70s, and we brought up Yuval Noah Harari, and I asked you this question about what that might be like. But bringing those together, he talks a lot about this idea of being cyborgs and even this transhuman idea. And there's quite a bit of fear often in this idea that we might be cyborgs. I stop and I pause and I think, well, a couple of years ago I had cataract surgery, so the lens in my eye is not my own. It's a piece of plastic. Would I give up my eye to have it be like, and this is where the 70s comes in, the $6 million man, Steve Austin? Would I change up my legs or my arms to have it be bionic? I mean, those are ethical questions we might ask, but I bet you there's more than one person who would probably say, yeah, I'd probably go for a bionic eye or bionic arm if it helped me do other things. Then we start to go into that cyborg piece, which also kind of talks a lot about what you mentioned in terms of this inability to disconnect the human and the machine.
Yeah. So look, Andy Clark talks a lot about this as well. Sort of this notion of extended mind, that actually we've had an extended mind since forever. You know, that we don't ever capture everything that we remember in our mind and keep it there. We need tools to surround us. Even a pen and a notepad is still a tool that we need to capture our mind. And so in some respects, you could say that we've kind of been cyborg for a long time. And Mustafa Suleiman, in his book, The Coming Wave, talks about Homo technologicus. And if you look at the work of James Lovelock, and he talks about this notion of the cyborg, I think it's a really interesting concept that he explores. Because basically, we've reached the point where we have these quantum level problems. Climate change, aging population. There are several problems that are massive, multi-layered, incredibly complex problems. And what James Lovelock suggests is that we will not be able to solve these alone. We're not going to be able to solve these. Our human minds, however brilliant our minds are, we're not going to be able to solve these quantum level problems alone. We need to team up essentially with AI. And I think he's probably right. It doesn't necessarily mean that we will have, physical implants like, Elon Musk's Neuralink implants. But we can talk about that as well, because I think that in itself is quite interesting. Doesn't necessarily mean we'll have those implants, but it does mean that in order to solve these problems, these quantum level problems, we are going to need an intelligence which is beyond our own. So, and I think this is where Lovelock actually is much more optimistic. So if you look at The Coming Wave, it's balanced equal parts optimism and sort of doomerism. And certainly if you look at people like Max Tegmark, there are a number of thinkers and ideas, people who are much more on the doomer side. I think Lovelock is quite firmly in the more optimistic side. I think if we are going to solve these problems, I would agree with him that actually the only way we're going to do it is if we team up. It's not going to solve these problems on its own, and neither are we. Then you come onto this kind of idea of the physical, physical joining, transhumanism notion, where we start to actually embed technologies into us. I mean, we've done this for a long time. I mean, you know, my father had a triple heart bypass and has a pacemaker, you know, and it's monitored remotely. So, you know, a hospital monitors his heart from remotely. So we've had this for a long time. So it's not new. You know, augmentation, the augmentation of the human body is not new. Prosthetic limbs, you know, hundreds of years old. But I think as soon as you start straying towards the human brain, it starts to seem to take on a different... So it's fine to have an implant in our heart. You know, it's fine to have a pacemaker in our heart or a pump to deliver insulin. Those things are fine. But as soon as we start talking about having a chip implanted in our brain, people start to get kind of stressed about that and think it's unethical. And there's some really interesting debates around that. I mean, one that I like to suggest is, okay, so let's say, for example, we do get to the point where it's a thing, it's a normal thing. You know, you can have implants done, but then the West bans it. Okay, so the West says, no, this is unethical, but I'm only using, you know, very, very broad brushstrokes, West and East. I mean, it's so nuanced, but you kind of get where I'm coming from. The East say, no, actually, we're allowing it. We can see competitive advantage. We have enhanced humans because we're implanting them with a chip, which just makes them think faster, think longer, think harder. They don't have to sleep as much. They're just way more productive. They're as a productive unit, an economic unit, these people double, triple in productivity. Okay, so then they allow that to happen. Well, that means that we have a whole kind of part of the world which is significantly more productive than the other part of the world. Well, what do we do? And then we say, okay, so we're going to let adults have these implants, but you've got to be over 18 and you've got to be beyond the age of consent, blah, blah, blah. Okay, what if another part of the world says, well, actually, no, we're just going to let anyone do it. We're going to implant our five-year-olds with a chip. And suddenly you have children who are just beyond, I mean, different league in terms of their abilities. What do you do? So I think it's once you start going down that slippery slope, then it becomes very, very, very challenging because you're thinking, well, where do you draw the line? You know, if we get to the point where we can create genuine cyborgs who are just, you know, as a simple economic unit of productivity, significantly more productive and able to gain the economy's huge advantage, then I mean, I don't know the answers to any. This is just a thought experiment. But I do think that the notion of the cyborg throws up so many interesting discussions that we really need to be having these discussions now.
And then people will react to this idea of reducing humans or cyborg humans into these units of production. And they will see that this is more capitalism, try to subsume our humanity, alienate, not just in the Marxian way of you are disconnected from your labor, but physically alienating yourself from your pure humanity, whatever that means. And yes, of course, that's a misconception. And that would be quite a resistant piece or a reason to resist, simply because we will work much like in 1984. I mean, I don't make it dystopian, but I'm just thinking of the image of everyone goes to work, goes to the factory, comes back, and that kind of idea. It is so easy to play in those current tropes of dystopia that we are there in order to produce. Never mind mind control.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, it doesn't take much of a leap to move dystopian with this. I mean, I'm still more on the optimistic side. I actually think it has huge potential to liberate us and to rid us of much of the things that, and actually to get us to look up from our screens as well. I think there is the potential for AI to free us from spending so much time interfacing with a screen and actually getting us to look up from our screens and interface. If so much of our screen time is taken up with kind of the process stuff, then actually if it can take away a lot of that, then maybe we can spend more time physically present with other people, which I think would be and in nature, and you know, which I think would be incredibly valuable. And that's my kind of my hope.
Let's take this in a positive way with these thought experiments. And of course, everything with thought experiments, it's like the that cow that physicists talk about that's perfectly round, but we're simplifying for the sake of argument, but if we had the ability to manipulate intelligence and capacity in such a way that we reduce the gaps between people and that we were all kind of leveled out at this super intelligent capability piece, maybe it might be a question that we could address some of these issues of crisis like you're pointing to. I haven't read the book, so I'm just going through my own imagination, but these issues of crisis, because the socioeconomic gaps might be reduced because everyone's kind of at the same level, maybe not. Maybe these ideas of sustainability, maybe we might not be in such a consumerist culture because we find ways to identify that are different. They're not based necessarily on wealth because everybody has the same potential. There's maybe it might be a question of finally realizing that there's just better ways to respond to the world. I don't know. Again, this is all very general and simple and idyllic and Disney-fied, but I'm just thinking about these possibilities of what might happen if we could reduce the gap for everyone, because there would be no one who would be we could cater to people's needs through some of these technologies.
I mean, yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it does. So I mean, that would be the ultimate aim of humanity, is to enable everyone, just talking from sort of Maslow perspective, you know, to everyone to reach the point of self-realization and fulfillment. But the fact remains that, you know, the majority of the world is caught at the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy, just fighting to survive. And the problem, of course, is that we are essentially motivated by a number of factors. You know, we talked earlier on about sort of striving and aiming for goals, but also we're competitive. And the only danger of kind of this sort of world where everyone is the same, or everyone has the same potential, or, you know, everyone has the same ability to realize themselves, would that potentially eliminate the notion of competition, that actually we know that we're going to be okay, and we know that, you know, things are going to be fine, and we're going to have enough to live on, and we don't need to kind of strive, and maybe there's a universal basic income because actually, you know, we have such abundance that we can pay people to do nothing. My worry is that without striving and goals, and without competing with other people, which can be positive and negative, but it can be very positive. Competition, I don't believe that everyone is a winner. I don't believe that for a moment. I think some people are better than other people in certain things, and I don't think everyone's going to be good at everything. But I think if we do reach the point where we don't have those goals to aim for, will we, and everyone's fine and happy and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, going back to the Marxist sort of notion of bread and circuses, you know, if everyone has their entertainment through social media and has full stomachs, what is left? You know, what is left for us as human beings if that's all? So I mean, I sound like I'm a real sort of pessimist doomer. I'm really not actually at all. I genuinely think there's huge potential, but I guess when you take it from the thought experiment point of view and you push things as far as they can go, although on the surface it may seem like everyone having infinite potential is a good thing, the downside could potentially be that we stop trying because we don't have to try.
And this is a good segue to get into schools and this idea that you mentioned, that the essay might very well be dead. This idea of structuring it in such a way that we could kind of standardize what we're trying to look at, the 5-paragraph essay, that might not be relevant anymore. This completely throws assessment on its head, and perhaps it's thank you very much, and now we could be a lot more collaborative, and we can actually be like in the professional world where we all work together, and nobody in the academic world even produces a paper by themselves anymore. And what are some of the possibilities here that are really going to jar a lot of folks in terms of the way that they look at the quality of thinking, the quality of arguments, perhaps the meaning that is made? What are some of the ways that we're going to have to reconsider the teaching and learning piece as means of trying to measure learning. And I mean that quantitatively and qualitatively.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the first question is what is assessment for? So what has been historically the purpose of getting students to sit an exam? And the first thing that comes to many people's minds as well, it's a measure of ability, academic ability and knowledge retention, et cetera, et cetera. And that is the case to some extent. But when you look at the real world and you look at, you know, the way people function in the real world, we simply do not sit exams, you know, so our worth is measured in so many different ways when you move into the world of work. I mean, you might do other qualifications, but essentially you're not sitting exams to show how good you are at something. You're measured by your output, you're measured by your results, you're measured by how well you can support other people in the furthering of their aims and so on and so forth. So if you take that as a starting point, the two reasons really why we sit exams are to move us from one stage to the next in the education system. So whether it be at 11, this in the UK, 11 plus, which might get us into a good grammar school, a good kind of top school, and then age 18 to get us to university. So we know that it's a transition certificate, if you like. It's a transition mechanism. It's all it is. And then the other reason that we have examinations is to judge the quality of teachers. So actually, a lot of exam, if you look at exam results and value add in particular, that's a quantitative measure of how well a teacher's doing their job. Because if a class does really badly in their English exam, well, and actually they did well in other exams. Well, let's look at the English teacher because clearly they're not very good at what they do. And so we need to do something about that. And it's the same with inspection. It's the same with any accreditation mechanism. So basically you've got students who are engaged in terminal exams to get them from one stage to the next and as a measure of the effectiveness of the system that they're in other words, the teacher. But neither of those address the reality of the fact that actually we need to be assessing really what they're capable of in of achieving as they progress into the world that it now is. And the world that now is very different from when the education was set up about 250 years ago. You know, Frederick the Great of Prussia set this up in the sort of 1780s, 1790s, the first system of its sort, 1780s, I think, but 1782 or three. So that, and then we move through with Horace Mann through the 19th century and into the various acts across the world in sort of towards the middle and the end of the 19th century. So you've got this kind of movement into what we all know, and I won't go into any depth because we've talked about it to death, the industrial model of education. And we still got it now. But essentially, the world is so different now than it was back then. I mean, it was probably not really fit for purpose then. It's certainly not fit for purpose now. So if we remove if we just divorce the fact that we examine kids to move them in on from one phase to the next and to assess the effectiveness of the education system they're in, what we actually need to be doing is we need to be continually assessing against certain criteria that we agree on these kids' ability to be in the world. So to be productive and beneficial members of the society that they're about to head into. And it might be that we need to be looking a lot more at project-based learning, that we need to look a lot more at setting students real world, you know, big, hairy, meaty problems for them to solve. You know, I was just speaking to a great guy who's working at a company where they're creating what he calls quests or projects centered around SDGs, because he recognizes that actually the most important problems that we need our young people to solve, many of them center around climate change and sustainable development. You know, so many of them, because these are the problems which basically this is the world they're heading into, and we've made a mess of it. So maybe we need to get their help. And so if that's the case, if we need to make sure that we're actually preparing our young people to really make a difference when they head into the world, why on earth are we getting them to do a GCSE in history and biology. It's a complete waste of time. I mean, it's an utter waste of time. What we need to be doing is designing a system which gets those young people to the point where they can be useful in the world. And that, do you know what? That use might come age 12. Or that might use come, that use may come age 30. You know, the notion that we have to 18 A levels or IB, and then you go to a degree till you're 21 and 22. This kind of like, it's a nonsense, because I have a 16-year-old daughter, and I can guarantee you she could add a lot more value to the world now than the majority of 20 and 30-year-olds, just because of the way her brain works and the fact she's extremely clever and very socially aware. We need to be giving opportunities for our young people to offer their what they have, their capabilities into the world at the right time for them. Doesn't mean we're going to set them off going into a job age 16, but it might be that we start blurring the boundaries between the real world and school. So actually what we're seeing is students and young people who are being prepared to be in the world with AI, with teacher support, with AI support, with the support of their peers, with support of experts coming in from the world of business or industry, that they're actually surrounded by like a network of support. And at the point they're ready, they're giving back. And I think if we can please remove these blocks that we have of, you know, you have to do your A-levels age 18 and you have to... There, for a lot of kids, I mean, if my daughter didn't want to go to university, I wouldn't bat an eyelid, because I know she's going to be okay. I think she will, but because she's very academic. But if she didn't, that would be okay. And I have a 7-year-old and a 4-year-old. If they don't end up at university, it's absolutely fine. Because I just don't think it will be long before the idea of having to do A-levels age 18 and having to do your degree age 21, 22, I just think it's no longer going to be a requirement, because we're going to develop a system or a way of being and a way of educating which just gets young people ready just to give back. Because that's basically, you know, back to my first point, you know, we gain fulfillment when we give back to the world.
This goes a lot along the lines of what we talk about on this podcast, is this idea of contribution, that the output actually doesn't really matter. It's how it contributes positively to all life. And when you talk about young people, I'm thinking a lot about the less young people who are also continuously going to have to learn. And perhaps that space opens up so that 5-year-olds and 65-year-olds and up are able to really be on this adventure of learning together, simply because people have to reinvent themselves for their careers, to use a cliche.
Yeah, you're right. And I, if you take that notion of continuous learning, lifelong learning, again, I don't like some of these terms because they've become quite hackneyed and quite cliched. And people talk about lifelong learning, don't really know what they're talking about. But I think if we consider the notion of what a school is, I think, and I'm hoping, what we will actually start to see are opportunities where we almost go back pre-industrial revolution. I call it kind of, I coined it about a year ago, techno-agrarian. So there's the idea of that agrarian economies that we had, where essentially you would have the older people teaching the younger people about how to live in the world, because they embodied their teaching. You see, the problem that we have now is that teachers generally don't embody their teaching. You know, you've got your English teacher and your history teacher, but they go and they teach the subject and then they have their life and they don't really necessarily mix. You know, you're a subject specialist and you're going to deliver a subject, but that's not necessarily the case that, I mean, for me, I think if you're arts, literature, philosophy, it may well be you're that way inclined. So you may well embody through your love of literature, or you maybe you're a writer, or maybe you are a philosopher in your spare time. But for many teachers, it's not embodied at all. They just go and do their job and then they come home and then they have their other life. But my hope is that actually, if we start moving back towards this kind of pre-industrial revolution model where we have much smaller collectives of people working together, that actually we might start to see the 65-year-old and the 5-year-old working on a problem together. You know, and maybe we'll even reach the point where we have, instead of these massive schools, well, very much like the Green School, actually. I think you're a really, really good example of that. You're your approach, I can kind of see from a model perspective being really, really interesting. But you have these smaller collectives of very embodied, placed in their environment, very much firmly placed in their environment, where you might have the students going off and doing some of their learning with mentors and with support. But maybe the parents, you know, if you have the idea of having kind of almost like a hub, like a learning work and learning hub, where the parents are working on their own jobs and careers, and then maybe they come together for lunch, or maybe at the end of the day, the mum and the daughter go off and learn a club together. You see, so almost like there's a separation from a safeguarding perspective, obviously, but also there's the opportunity during the day for people to learn from each other, and that it's not just I'm going to go to my English lesson and I'm going to have a lesson with Mr. Smith, who teaches English in a monotone and then clearly has got no interest in the subject when he leaves work, towards actually these are people who all embody the lives that they live and embody their teaching. Because when I look back at my school career as a student, there is actually only one man who stands out to me as being who I loved. And the reason I became an English teacher, the reason I studied English at university, and the reason I became an English teacher because of this man. And the reason that he was a very good teacher, but also he was a mountaineer and he was a writer and he'd written several books on mountaineering, and he would bring them in and he would read passages from his books and he would show his photographs. And he embodied his subject because he embodied writing and he embodied a love of words. And that really resonated with me. And I think if the more we can move towards having teachers who embody what they love and embody what they teach, I just think that for me is like the most important thing about being a teacher, because it connects what you're teaching with how you live your life. And if you connect those two together, I think for children, that's incredibly powerful.
And going back to this pre-industrial way, there's also this idea of masterpiece and this idea that you could create an artifact of learning, a piece of work, something that comes from you, and a panel of experts, which looks at maybe equivalence rather than standardization, says, well, by gosh, that's pretty good. that is something that's worthy of a masterpiece, and that being the credential that you walk away with rather than the standardized essay, as we mentioned earlier. I love this idea of bringing in people from all sorts of backgrounds, maybe 3 to 5, to say, well, you know, please defend your artifact and let us know what the process is, and let's look at the quality of what that might be.
I mean, that's, you know, we one of the most popular TV shows for probably the last 10 to 15 years. In the UK, it's called Dragon's Den, and across the world, Shark Tank. The reason it's so powerful is because that's exactly what happens, is that basically you have small business owners who present their ideas to a panel of experts, and they're either judged yes or no, in the kind of Roman, you know, thumbs up, thumbs down, but also I will invest money in your idea. So that's the ultimate accolade, is when you have a dragon or a shark who says, you know, this is a brilliant idea. I actually can see that working really well in a school setting. And what I can see happening, and I'd love to see businesses start to look at this, is that you would essentially have businesses coming into schools and running their own like venture programs, where you would basically get the students delivering their ideas to a panel of experts who would then actually take those students on as apprentices into the business. So age 18, you could do your academic route, your university route, but you could also potentially pitch your idea to a McKinsey or a Bain or a, you know, Ernst & Young or one of the big four. And then they would say, do you know what? Brilliant. You're coming in and I'm going to take you age 18, age 19, onto this program, and you're going to get the degree level education. So you'll get a certification, but you're not going to get into debt, and you're going to become a productive. Because if you think we basically have units, and it sounds awful, but you know, let's face it, it's the way the world works. We have units of productivity who are draining the system until the age of 21, 22. And then they drain the system from sort of age 60, 65 onwards, you know, so they sort of bookend. And then we've got maybe 40 years in the middle where we're productive. But actually, if businesses start to bring young people into the fold, age 18 and 19, and give them real world experience plus an education, but then the transition point is not an exam, it's pitching to a panel I actually think that could be incredibly powerful.
Well, listen, Darren, I really want to thank you for your time. What's on your mind? What's on your horizons? What are some of the things that, you're going to be up to?
Yeah, so I mean, my main focus at the moment is, well, it's twofold. So working with organizations, so mainly education, so affiliate bodies, schools groups, again, looking at the back office, looking at their efficiencies, looking at the whole piece, the back and front office. So both from right from the back, right the way to how a teacher delivers the lesson, how all of that can be optimized and impacted with AI. And then focusing on basically solutions linking to sort of natural language chatbots for various functions, from answering queries on a school website in a very natural, very intuitive way, through to working with a property developer on a chatbot for a developed property development. So it's kind of weird, really, very, very mixed. But everything centers around how can AI impact at the moment that it's needed, not just bringing it in across the piece, but really just bring it in a very targeted way that can increase productivity, that can make us do more with data, and that can kind of move learning on in sort of weird and wonderful ways.
And how do people get a hold of you?
So you can connect with me via LinkedIn, follow me, Darren/Coxon on LinkedIn. All of my contact details are on there. That's the best way of initially contacting me. And you can also book a call through me through LinkedIn. So yeah, so that's usually the best way to connect with me.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Benjamin.
This has been the Coconut Thinking Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Check us out, www.coconut-thinking.com. That's www.coconut-thinking.com. And of course, subscribe and leave 5 stars. We are so looking forward to our next guest, and hopefully we'll hear from you, get some messages and comments. And well, until we do so, see you next time. Bye-bye.